I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 207 of Caro Pop. If you'd like to support us and keep this thing going, please go to caropop.com. Our guest this week is making his second Caro Pop appearance, but this time we have a specific topic to discuss. 1967. Singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock has released not only an album with that title, but also a memoir.
I take my vacation in the past.
The album 1967 is subtitled Vacations in the Past. The memoir is titled 1967, How I Got There and Why I Never Left. Hitchcock turned 14 in 1967, so that was a pivotal year for him biologically as well as musically. He was a student at Winchester College, a boarding school about 70 miles southwest of London. Hanging out with his fellow groovers, as he calls them now, the young Hitchcock became immersed in the music of what would be a landmark year. Hitchcock's mind already had been expanded by Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde and other works. Then came the Technicolor psychedelia of Pink Floyd's Arnold Lane, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, and See Emily Play, the Beatles' Strawberry Fields Forever, and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the Jimi Hendrix experiences, Are You Experienced, the incredible string bands, The 5,000 Spirits or The Layers of the Onion, and more. A young Brian Eno shows up on occasion as well. And when, as 1967 turned to 1968, Bob Dylan released the stripped-down John Wesley Harding, the spell was broken. Anyone who has seen or listened to Robin Hitchcock knows that he has a whirligig mind that spins out colorful tales and deep insights as well as beautiful music in a way that no one else could. Those qualities are on display as he transports you to his Winchester College dorm in his memoir, performs mostly acoustic versions of key 1967 songs on his album, and talks about it all here. Would the music of 1967 have had such an outsized impact on his own music, if not for where, how, and at what age he experienced it? Hitchcock also talks about the January 9th release of a remixed and remastered version of the 1988 Robin Hitchcock and the Egyptians album, Globe of Frogs. That's the one that gave the world Balloon Man and other indelible songs. Why did he want to go back and tweak the sound of this one? I'm a big fan of 1967, the year in music and Hitchcock's book and album. I loved the chance to be a fellow groover with him as we batted around perhaps the most creatively explosive year in the rock era. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Robin Hitchcock.
I was a young man.
It's interesting because I'm sort of a like 60s file, 1967 file, but I was three and I used to sort of imagine, well, what would it have been like to, you know, be like a conscious music listener when, you know, you're putting on Sgt. Pepper for the first time and hearing it all the way to the end and hearing Day in the Life. And that's It's basically what your book is about, is like having come of age at just the right time for that year, right?
Yes, yes. So does the book, does the book give you that feeling? Does it help you towards that feeling?
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And just sort of the sequence of like this came out or this came out, and also the kind of, you know, clubbiness of, you know, these friends that you're with and sort of sneaking out secretly sort of the secret language that, you know, embracing the stuff has, and that there's the stuff that's super popular, but then there's also the stuff kind of really under the radar, and you have you know, club with that.
Right. Well, that's how it happened for me. And I suppose everybody coming of age in that time would have a different story about how that music landed with them. You know, specifically the music from 1965 to 1968, which is now sort of seen as the birth of rock. And, you know, is definitely a matrix. It's as big a matrix in popular culture as rock and roll, possibly greater, you know. And that was the one I experienced as I became a teenager. As, you know, my life went into color, the world went into color, the Beatles movies went into color. It was just an extraordinary piece of momentum that I bore witness to.
And that was a period where, like, for you, being 14 is different from being 15, which is different from being 16, and the music of 1964 is very different from 65 or 66 or 67 or 68 in a way that I don't think this is just because we're older, but I think it would be hard. You'd be hard to say, oh, you know, 2011 was a much more distinct year than 2012. You know, it's like those dramatic changes don't happen now the way they did then.
Not in music and fashion. They probably are happening in technology. So there are, yeah, are probably people to whom each of those years is really different. You know, that by the end of 2025, they're looking back at the beginning of 2024 and going, God, was that only last year? I mean, we can do that politically, of course, because of happened in terms of the way things look and sound. I mean, I think things are changing as fast, but just not in the same way, and not necessarily in a benign way. So I was lucky to be able to measure my life out in those kind of growth spurts. Yeah.
I mean, you're at Winchester College. It's a boarding school, basically. You're not in university at this point. Mm-mm. How much of how you experienced that music of 1967 and the way it stuck with you, do you think was tied into your being in boarding school as opposed to not, or doing something else?
I think it was tied in. It probably became even more intense because we weren't free to roam. You know, we weren't able to just go off and sneak off to gigs and that kind of thing, you know, have trysts with girls. I mean, and that said, some people did, but, you know, so we were in Winchester in Hampshire, so there weren't any gigs. Bizarrely, Brian Eno was actually at the local art school. He was a student, not a teacher. So we did have him there acting as a guru. And he was a key part of it to me. But no, it was all the more intense because it was a hermetic world, you know.
Yeah.
We were all locked 7 in the evening or whatever. And then let out of the cage at 7 in the morning and had to wear funny hats and stuff. You know, we were very much creatures apart from the rest of the world. We were encouraged to feel that way. And I think that then stays with you in later life. You know, I don't know if you ever become a truly naturalized citizen of the world.
You were a groover. You were a groover and not a meathead.
Well, I was a groover. That's my term for it. You know, I called that, and that's the sort of, you know, post-dated term. I don't think we called ourselves groovers back then. I mean, the term originated around then, supposedly, as you may know, that Doug Sahn described Austin as a groover's paradise.
Right. He has an album of that name.
You know, and that was probably right around that time. But certainly we weren't calling ourselves groovers in Winchester College. But, you know, that's what we were. Those amongst us who were hip.
Do you think also if you'd been a little bit older, a little bit younger, it would have stayed with you in the same way?
Not exactly, no, you know, because I did actually hit puberty in 1967. That was the year I had the big, you know, I grew 5 inches or whatever it was. You know, I physically started out the year as a boy, and I wound up as a very, very young man. You had to be exactly that age for it to hit you exactly that way. But I've got a lot of, you know, elderly friends who remember that time, and I check in with them here and there.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously there's still something very lasting about, you know, whether you're talking about White or Shade of Pale or Day in the Life or, you know, Ichiku Park or Waterloo Sunset or See Emily Play. I mean, these are indelible, timeless songs, whatever age you were. You know, like I love them, and again, I was 3 at the time.
Well, that's great. I mean, that what's reassuring for me to hear about that is that it means the music actually has some lasting potency. It's not simply, oh, it was great at the time, but, you know, actually I can't really see what the fuss was all about, you know. So I suppose it validates it a bit, you know.
So the songs that you cover on the 1967 album, and a lot of what you talk about, and sort of the crux of it, like a lot of it was British music. Do you think that 1967 was kind of owned by English artists? Over here you have like Hendrix and some other stuff, but really the crux of it is these Tomorrow, no, Pink Floyd, Procol Harum.
No, the reason for that was simply that in those days things took much longer to cross the Atlantic. So we were reading in the music papers about Jefferson Airplane and the Dead, and you know, there were rumors of the Velvet Underground, and the Byrds, you know, we had the Byrds albums at school. Hendrix, as you say, was American, but started in Britain. Right. It was very clear that it was happening in the States. But the reason that I'm just being very literal. The reason that I, on that record, recorded mostly British acts is because those were the records that we actually had either on the radio or in the house at school in 67. Once we got into 68, then we got the Doors, you know, we got Forever Changes, the Surrealistic Pillow, the early Dead records, Velvet Underground, you know, appeared. I mean, the music appeared. I've even thought of doing a 1967 America, but to me, Robin Hitchcock in Winchester in Hampshire in southern England, you know, 67, what we actually heard, me and my schoolmates, was British. So when I made that record, apart from Go to San Francisco, which was a radio hit, I simply played, all I did was record the songs that I was hearing then.
Right.
Glad you brought that up, but actually, no, I mean, what I heard in 67 was British, but all this other stuff was just flickering across the Atlantic. And of course, Bob Dylan, who was the, you know, my original Pied Piper, our original guru, our right. shaman, the man that started it all, you know. But Dylan was, of course, silent in 1967. So being a literal fellow, I didn't record any Bob Dylan songs for my 67 album. Although the 67 book, you know, in some ways is a sort of love letter to Bob Dylan. So Dylan was the prime mover. I mean, I could very easily do a collection of 67, 66, you know, around that time of American stuff, and maybe I should.
Right. Well, and but Dylan, I mean, John Wesley Harding is either a very late 67 or a very early 68 album. I mean, most people obviously experience it in 68, but if you sort of look it up, it's like, oh, it was released technically on December 27th of 67. It's like, well, the purpose it serves in the book and the purpose it kind of served in the music world was that album almost was like declaring the end of 1967 in a way, right? Because it's just so stripped back and...
But yeah, it was like he looked at everything that was going on and decided to go the other way. And the fascinating thing is how he took everybody with him. And you could see it happening. I mean, you know, people, especially in Britain, Britain was always a very faddish, trendy place, you know, before the internet, really. So Flower Power had been in for 6 months and people were looking for something else. They weren't all going to vamp around in caftans and beads for another year. You know, people wanted something new. So Dylan just came out with this record with no backwards guitar, no sitars, no harmonies, no phasing, no double tracking, no flanging, no keyboard solos, not even like the sort of, you know, the music he made with the band, which was live, was kind of magical and intense and almost like a precursor to Jimi Hendrix. You could almost have dropped Jimi Hendrix on top of, you know, one of Dylan's live 66 shows. It would have been perfect. That mania and exaltation were all gone with John Wesley Harding. I'm actually doing
I saw that.
58th anniversary is indeed 27th of December. So I've just been having to write about all this for the Substack and stuff. It's a complete reversal. And he took the Stones, he took the Beatles, anyone who listened, and everybody listened to Dylan, especially because he'd been mute for 18 months. So when Dylan came out with this new record, everyone went, right, what's this? Ah, okay, you know. And I've said before, you know, Dylan did Dear Landlord, so the Beatles did Dear Prudence and the Stones did Dear Doctor. You know, it just sort of, just watch it go the other way. You know, the sumptuous cover of Sergeant Pepper is replaced by a complete blank for the White Album. And Dylan was the Dylan got there first. He started the great leap backwards, and
the big retreat. I think you called it
the big retreat, whatever I call it on the record. You know, on my book, it was very apparent that what he was doing. And yeah, you're right. It absolutely was. You know, it was the end. Okay. There goes 67. We didn't actually get it in Britain until February 68. But yeah. Somebody brought me an import copy. So as soon as I got back to school in early 68, we heard John Wesley Harding. Yeah, it was just suddenly woomph, you know.
Yeah, because I saw that on December 27th at the Bearsville Theater. This is in your Facebook. You said you'll be playing John Wesley Harding. And in the book, you talk about, getting John Wesley Harding, and you're so excited because you just loved Blonde on Blonde, and he's one of these people who knew the meaning of life. Yeah. And your phrase is that the album was flat, beige, and not much fun to listen to. Is that something that came around for you, or?
No. I mean, the point is that I had to love it. I had to take it in. It just wasn't particularly enjoyable. I mean, what it did have going for it was a lot of symbolism, which still works now when you listen to it. In terms of sound, it's never been a very attractive record. Even Nashville Skyline was nicer to listen to, and Self-Portrait, whatever people thought of the songs, the actual music on the record was just nicer. John Wesley Harding's so stark. You had that very sharp harmonica, and then there was almost nothing except Dylan's voice and an out of tune guitar, and then you've got the bass and the drums doing a great job of keeping it going, and Kenny Buttrey's doing all these great drum figures, and Charlie McCoy, who's still alive actually, he's pushing it along on the bass. But musically, it was never very, just wasn't really very enjoyable, you know. And Dylan had pioneered a series of records that got richer musically. Highway 61 and Blonde on Blonde. The music seemed to work so well with the words. It's been on and off ever since, I think, for Dylan. Sometimes I wish he'd just sit there with an acoustic or a piano or something. But no, John Wesley Harding was a disappointment, but you know, we bloody well had to love it, because at least he had meant, all right, if nothing else, he's still there. He's not exactly what you thought or you hoped. And it was like that when he appeared at the Isle of Wight the year after that, you know. It was a miracle he was going to appear in our, essentially like our back garden. I only lived 30 miles from the Isle of Wight. And there was old Bob playing Down and Ride, you know. But like I think I said in the book, it's like a dream. You keep waiting to meet your lover, your dream person. And then when they appear, they don't look like you thought they did, you know. But Dylan's always been great at confounding expectations, and he's always at his best. I think when he tries to give people what they want, or what he thinks they want, I don't think it's quite so good.
Is your John Wesley Harding show going to be solo or with the band?
It's acoustic. I've got another chap with me, Luther Russell, who's going to play some 12 string. And I hopefully Emma will join us for harmonies on something. It'll be a little bit different. It's going to have related material as well. It's not just to do with. It's not just because the album itself is only 40 minutes. So, in order to provide a, you know, an hour and a half's entertainment, I'm going to do songs that I think are connected to John Wesley Harding in different ways. Give the record some context.
Are you performing in order, or are you going to do the songs of it interspersed with other things?
Oh, no. I'm going to do the record as I'm not going to mess about with the sequence.
Right.
But there'll be a little bit before, and I think there'll be a little bit after as well.
When you and I spoke last time, you said that you don't think there's anything that you've recorded that wouldn't have fit on the White Album. And I'm stylistically or whatever. And it made me wonder in reading this, whether you think ultimately 67 or 68 kind of had a bigger imprint on what you ended up doing, even though obviously in this book, you say I've been living in 67 ever since.
Well, you wouldn't have 1968 without 1967, would you?
So there you go.
I think I probably, in terms of records I feel influenced by, I think that the Harvest from 1966 is probably at the very top. Then with 67 combined, once you throw in Jimi Hendrix and Pink Floyd and Traffic and I suppose also Sgt. Pepper and the other stuff the Beatles did. And the Incredible String Band, I suppose, must have affected me quite a lot.
Right.
So there was, I mean, the thing with by the time the White Album comes out, the Beatles aren't making slick professional records like they had been. You know, there's quite a lot of sort of stoned waywardness, you know, beautifully engineered and edited and stuff, but things like Wild Honey Pie and Revolution 9 and all the odd things that go on between tracks, you know, it's very much a kind of hippie record in a way. Not that I think my records are particularly, but the White Album also has an enormous breadth of style. So you've got all of them sitting there with acoustic guitars pretty much by themselves at various points. Then you've got essentially heavy metal with things like Helter Skelter and Everybody's Got Something to Hide, you know. So just the breadth of styles that the White Album encloses has, is, I mean, I think everything I do pretty much would fit in somewhere there.
One of the interesting things to me about 67 versus 68 also is that there's sort of a timestamp element to a lot of 67, you know, with the Mellotron, the phase shifting, the, you know, kind of the backward stuff, the ornate sort of, you know, there's just like the drum sound on Sgt. Pepper and, you know, Magical Mystery Tour for that way. It doesn't sound like the drums on any other Beatles records. Whereas 68, I feel like in a way is the first modern rock year in that like your full band stuff on the White Album or Beggar's Banquet sounds like, you know, if someone recorded something now, it might not sound that different. Whereas if you record something that sounds like 67, you're like, oh, that sounds like 67.
Well, maybe, yeah. I mean, it was all pop music up till 67, and then it came out into rock, you know, so in 68 was when it began to crystallize as rock music. And, you know, things like rhythm guitar wasn't really needed anymore because lead guitar was so loud. You still had rhythm guitar in sort of the Velvet Underground and Creedence Clearwater and things. But even in the Beatles, it wasn't really just John on rhythm and George on lead. Everybody was playing everything. But I mean, yeah, I mean, I basically agree with you that there were those, particularly the mellotron and the phasing and all that, which seemed to come in bang on 1967 and wasn't really around prior to that. But there was just such incredible momentum, you know.
So when you decided you wanted to record an album of 1967 songs, did you think all along, you know, I'm going to strip these back, do these without drums for the most part, and sort of get at the heart of the songs? Or was there part of you that was sort of tempted to start throwing in kind of the production kitchen sink on some of it?
No, there was no point throwing in production kitchen sink, because that's what had been thrown in the first time around.
Right.
The only reason for me to put those versions out is because they were like folk versions of songs that had been around for ages. I mean, some of them, like Waterloo Sunset, you know, I've been playing that at parties and encores for 50 years. And I've been playing, I think, Day in the Life like that too. You know, quite a few of them I've just sort of played acoustically anyway. Even Emily. So it just made sense to do the whole record, what I call campfire psychedelia, you know. Because those songs have really passed into folk music, certainly for people like me who grew up with them. They're still great songs. So you can sit there with two acoustics, which is how most of those are recorded. I'm either with Kimberly Rue in Cambridge or with Davy Lane in Sydney. And it just seemed like that's what they've become. You know, they started out as these exquisite bits of production, but they just turned into songs that people could sit there with acoustics and play.
Well, and it also sort of demystifies a song like A Day in the Life, which is such a massive production, and yet it's a beautiful song played the way you play it without, and it's not that you don't still get into the dissonances and everything else and your campfire psychedelia at the end. But it's also a song that you can play with, you know, just on acoustic guitar, even with all those shifts and crazy little parts. And it's like, no, oh, that's still a fantastic song.
Well, Day in the Life is actually very, most of it's really sparse. It's acoustic guitar, piano, and drums, cavernous drums. I don't think George is even, I think George is just playing maracas on it. And then you've also got the orchestra that comes in at certain points.
Right.
And you've got Mal Evans with the alarm clock and all of that.
But, and the counting down of it.
Yeah, but Day in the Life, it's most of Day in the Life is actually pretty stark, which is how Davy and I played it, you know, in Sydney, except we didn't have any percussion. But I'm not sure there's even a bass on Day in the Life. I suppose there is, but I think Paul's playing piano. I'm sure he is. But once you have orchestras involved, things seem, you know, expansive and expensive.
But I just had to look.
I read the book a bit ago. My memory was that you were sort of meeting in there to hear the Velvet Underground and Nico, but then that didn't happen. What was your first impression when you finally heard the Velvet Underground and Nico? Because it is so different from a lot of this other stuff.
Oh, well, I didn't hear that till 1968, so it didn't go in the book.
I think you were like, you heard about it. It was rumored. You're meeting up with your friends, and then the guy didn't show up,
It's rumored, yeah, that's right. Richard Hobson talked about it. I loved it. I mean, I think I played side two first. I played Heroin first.
Wow.
And it was one of the few records that I liked immediately. I didn't have to sort of get into it by hearing other kids play it. And then I would go, oh, this isn't bad. What is it? Put it on and I put it on again. I mean, I borrowed a copy from somewhere, but someone. No, I absolutely loved it.
Because side two is definitely the more challenging side, because you got, like, you know, European Sun, Black Angel's Death Song. So, like, once you get past I'll Be Your Mirror, it's like, strap in.
European Sun's a bit of a mess, but, I mean, by then you're kind of hooked, I think. They just seem to have a very... You could really feel what they were about, what they seemed to be about, which was something sort of dark and merciless, but also very romantic and kind of cut the crap. You know, Lou Reed's voice was very incisive. Nico's voice was sort of dreamy but doomy. So there wasn't anything sort of wistful or pastoral or things that were in fashion at the time. It all seemed quite focused in a way. Angry and exciting and sort of, you know, screw you, I think, was a big element of that. It felt something like you could kill your neighbor's flowers with.
Did it feel like a refutation of a lot of what had come before in 67? Because you do think of, like, Summer of Love, you know, this kind of idealistic thing, and this is not that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. No, I think it more harked back to Bob Dylan. I just sort of felt like it kind of satisfied the Jones I had for Dylan. And I think maybe especially because John Wesley Harding had come out and Dylan was moving away from that kind of enlightened malevolence, you know. He wasn't suffering from curly hair and sunglasses anymore. He was trying to be a kind of wise old farmer or whatever. And so I think Lou Reed and, you know, they were all there in their sunglasses looking mean, looking like they knew something, but it wasn't anything very nice. But, you know, it definitely appealed to me. I was never all that love and peace. You know, I just loved the music.
In the book you write, "I wish I had a girlfriend. I wish I had a friend, really. I'm a teenager and I'll stay one for the rest of my life."
Yeah.
What part of being a teenager do you feel like still sticks with you?
Well, I think the part of me that feels like I haven't gone very far from childhood, actually. So arguably I'm even a preteen. I think of myself emotionally as somebody who never really got beyond about 14. I think of myself as someone with arrested development, just because I can intellectualize things and I'm articulate and I can be concise, doesn't mean I've actually grown up, you know. And I think my reactions to things are still very childish and childlike, which probably keeps me youthful, if not young. And I know, I just, maturity is something I don't think I'll ever have. And I think I'm still processing what happened back then, you know, musically, psychologically. You know, maybe one day I'll grow up and leave home and learn to drive and get some insurance.
But do you feel like that energy drives you creatively? That, you know, the reason you're restless and performing and making new music and, you know, looking back at other old music is because you just have that same sort of drive you had when you were much, much younger?
I think so, because that doesn't really seem to have gone away. And as one's life goes on and there's less and less ahead of you and more behind you, it just increases my urgency. You know, I'm less and less inclined to, well, you know, I wouldn't mind just laying back. You know, I would like to spend more time with the cats, that's all. And I'm hoping I'm going to be able to do that and do some painting. But what I'm good at is screaming around the world and doing shows and churning out music, doing interviews. You know, this is what I do. I've spent my life doing it. And it'll be taken from me soon enough. But I don't feel, maybe if I grew up, it would be over.
Do you have like certain ambitions of like the kind of art you still want to put out into the world that you haven't yet? Or is it just a matter of, I'm going to do what I do?
I would like to do more painting because I think I'm getting better at it. And I'm not a natural, I'm not a great painter at all, but my stuff reproduces quite well. We do these Giclée prints now. Emma's had them at a place in London that makes them. And my pictures come out quite bright. And I've also started using fluorescent paints. So I'm actually just inclined to produce brighter and brighter pictures as my eyes grow dim. And I just, so I feel like I've got quite a long way. I feel like I could keep painting. I think I'm still getting better as a guitarist. I don't think I'm necessarily getting any better as a songwriter. I probably did my best work years ago. And I think it's quite hard to, because I'm not absorbing lots of new music all the time. So I'm not learning new instruments, or I'm kind of repelled by technology. So I don't, you know, once the Mellotron stuff happened, that was it for me. I've never had a drum machine. I'm not interested in programming or sampling. I just don't have the patience.
Yeah, but nobody wants to hear a drum machine sampling record from you, so I think you're good.
Not from me, but they're quite happy to hear it from other people.
Yeah, but there's still those of us who like hearing what, I mean, Shuffle Mania is terrific, so.
Thank you, it's sweet of you. I mean, it's all okay, it's fine. All I'm saying is I don't think I'm breaking new ground as a songwriter, but I do think I am developing as a visual artist, and I'm also, I think, developing as a writer. I really enjoyed writing 1967, and I'm so glad you like it.
Absolutely.
So glad other people like it. And that's a new thing I'd never done before, is take a little section of my life and put it there chronologically as lucidly as I could for people to read, so they can sort of experience what I experienced. I'm also, you know, having done all this for decades, I'm quite keen to give my work some context. And that may involve people having a better understanding of my life and how it happened. So I've got another book coming out, which goes from 1968, when I began to play the guitar and process this incredible music, up to 1978, when I had the Soft Boys and we were about to get a record deal in London and we were just beginning to appear to get somewhere professionally. And it's not just about that at all, but it covers that period. I'm not saying I can explain myself, but I want to put myself in context. So if I think it would help my songs, you know, people could see, oh, I see, you know, some people pick up on them. It's just bottling bits of your life. You know, songs are bottled bits of life. They're little moments, like Traffic had that great line about capturing moments of life in a jar. I think Jim Capaldi wrote that. And I think that's what songs are. You just have a little section of your life and you keep really living it for people and yourself, I suppose. And so I'm just trying to capture bits of my life while I still remember them and package them into narratives. So anyway, I've got this other one coming out. I'm just finishing the illustrations. There'll be an announcement to that, you know, but I'm just letting you know it's done.
Okay.
I don't know if I'll do another one after that, but all I mean, Mark, is that there's things like writing and painting, I think I'm still developing at, and songs, you know, they appear or they disappear. I've already recorded, you know, 758 songs or something. So I don't sort of, they're kind of by the by. Maybe that's one of the reasons that I still feel kind of energetic, is because I've got all these other things going on that I think I'm getting better at, you know.
Do you really have new songs for another album, or is that just...
Yeah, like, a new album recorded as well, and the title with that will appear soon enough. You know, but that's not really news. You know, I've had new albums out for nearly 50 years, whereas another book is, you know, I've only had one book out, so
right.
That's to me is the bigger deal, really. And, you know,
are there other experiences you're looking for in terms of meeting people you haven't met, collaborating with people you haven't collaborated with?
No, I don't want to meet anybody. I don't want to collaborate with anybody. I mean, I've met Brian Eno. I met him again last year. I meet him every 12 years. It's nice.
So when you met Brian Eno, did you say, oh, did you know that you had this influence on me when I was back in, you know, boarding school?
I think I mentioned it to him a while ago when I first met him in adult life. I think he's amused by the fact that I remember all this, because his public life didn't really start until Roxy Music. So right. I'm that thing of, I remember you when you were only 19, you know, so I'm a sort of specter from his past. But Joe Boyd actually gave Brian a copy of my book. Last time I saw both of them together. They're both older than me, and they're both inspirations, because they're guys who were cool in the 60s. They're still cool now, and they're still, you know, they're still up there. They're sort of relatively sexy figureheads. They've stayed the right side of their drink and drugs and things. They haven't had to become horribly sober or anything. They're just sort of, they were men full of ideas and potential, and they still seem to be that way. So, you know, I like to feel like I'd belong to that club. But I don't want any new experiences. I mean, apart from, obviously, if I could levitate or create world peace or something like that, but they're not experiences that I know that anyone else has had yet. You know, there are many things I would do if I had magical powers, but that's another story. But I don't think people do.
So you're not going to do like a duets album where you just like get all your idols together and...
No, I'd rather learn to teleport or have a time machine or something like that, you know, or communicate telepathically with cats.
We already do that, don't we?
Well, I hope so. Have you got any cats?
Oh, yeah. No, I have two cats. They're very cute.
Oh, right. How old are they?
One is 16 and one is two or three.
Oh, wow. How do they relate to each other?
Wonderfully. They fought for the first month when we got Tina, the little one. It's Tina and Prince. We had to keep them apart for about a month. And then they started curling up together. I'll sit on my couch with a little lap desk on, and Prince will kind of lie alongside my leg, and then Tina will curl up on my leg and on Prince. It's very cute.
Oh, well, that's pretty advanced. Okay, well, then maybe there's a degree of telepathy going on. Yeah, I think measuring out one's life in cats is a great thing.
January 9th, you got your remixed, remastered version of Globe of Frogs coming out.
Oh, God, I hope so. Yes. That's for public consumption. That is coming out, well, physically. It should physically be with us. So we'll be mailing them out. Yeah, it's...
And it was 88, right? So it'll be...
88, yes. So it's 37 years later. It was made the same year that the guys I'm currently working with were born. So what we've done is Brad Jones and I... Brad's a great engineer, producer. He's worked with a lot of people over here in Nashville. Basically, we've just made it sound nicer, I think. I mean, hopefully not too middle-aged, but we've taken a lot, we've scraped off a lot of the digital patina from the drums. We've taken a bit of the aggressive sound off the bass. We've muted a few keyboard overdubs, and we've made my vocal a bit more tuneful than it was.
What does that mean?
It means it's just more in tune, you know.
I mean, are you like actually auto-tuning your vocal then?
No, Brad just takes the tape out and beats it with a hammer, you know.
Okay, good.
But it's, we're just generally, it sounds nicer. I mean, it doesn't sound artificial, but it sounds... I mean, it was very well recorded at the time. I wish I could go in and redo the vocals. I don't really like my vocal tone much, but that would be cheating. So it's the OG vocals, and it's the OG takes.
It's what you sounded like at the time. That was what, you know, when that came out, I'm like, that's Robin Hitchcock. I talked to you for the Boston Phoenix for that record. That was my job out of college. I was writing for the Boston Phoenix.
Gosh, okay. Well, hopefully it won't freak you out too much.
No. I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. I remember I misspoke with you because I referred to, I think I said something about tropical fish mandala and you said flesh. Oh. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, sorry. I misspoke.
Yeah. No, I could see why people would think that. I think it's good. I mean, I've listened to the new one quite a lot. And it does sound, it just sounds a bit less embedded in the 1980s, you know. Because if you go back a few years before that to Underwater Moonlight, which we've also just remastered.
Right, which sounds very good. I got that one.
That doesn't have any of the 80s patina on it. You know, we couldn't afford to have digital snare sounds. I'm not, you know, they weren't around for the likes of us. The bass was just a bass. It wasn't treated through a whole load of flanges. And I think the keyboard machines that were used on Globe of Frogs hadn't been invented when we recorded Underwater Moonlight. So in some ways it's going back to a more organic sound, you know.
There's an early 80s sound that I think people associate as the sound of the 80s, you know, like Soft Cell or, you know, just a lot of the synthy stuff. But yeah, there's a distinct late 80s sound that that's a little more subtle, but that drum sound in particular, like the kind of loud, kind of digital gated drums. Yeah. There are a lot of records you go back to, and the one thing that you think, even if the rest of it doesn't sound so quote-unquote 80s and isn't drowning in synths, you'll be like, oh, that drum sound.
Yeah, well, hopefully we've got rid of some of that. So I hope this doesn't freak everybody out.
No. I don't remember thinking of Globe of Frogs as a particularly time-stamped record in that way anyway, but I just 88 is like I associate with that.
Yeah. Drum. Oh, no, I think we've untime-stamped it even more, really. Yeah.
There you go. Well, good. Well, great. I look forward to hearing it. Are you going to do that with any other albums of yours then?
See how this one does. Because it's, you know, it's, there's a certain amount of money you have to, you know, it's not cheap to remaster, remix and all the rest of it. So let's see how this one does. And if it's actually worth taking the trouble, you know.
Is there one in your mind that you'd most like to do next, if you could?
No, I think a lot of that stuff from the 80s would be going in either direction, later or earlier, would be a candidate for it. You've got the multi-tracks, so we can do that, but you have to bake them as well. So, you know, it's a bit of a process. So we'll see, you know, when Frogs is out, that's great, but no, you know, tell the world it'll physically exist from whenever it is, in 2 or 3 weeks' time, I think.
Thank you so much, and I can't wait to read the next book and hear the next album. That's it for episode 207 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Robin Hitchcock for speaking with us again about his music and artistry and how the year 1967 had such a big impact on all of it. Go to robinhitchcock.com to learn more about all he does and to find links to buy the 1967 memoir and album and the new Globe of Frogs vinyl release, which is out January 9th. Or go right to tinyghostrecords.shop. The site for his and Emma Swift's label that offers all sorts of great music, plus Hitchcock's paintings, illustrations, and limited edition prints. Hitchcock has January and February tour dates in Houston, Dallas, and Austin, Texas, as well as 4 Colorado towns, plus Seattle and Portland, Oregon. On April 9th, he's kicking off electric full band shows at Turf Club in St. Paul, Minnesota, followed by April 10th at Chicago's Athenaeum Center and April 11th at Toronto's Horseshoe Tavern. Go to robinhitchcock.com for more information and follow his Facebook and Instagram pages as well. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who also likes to see Emily play. Thanks to all who support Carol Pop. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative, and I'll give you a shout-out on the next episode. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the so-called socials at Caro Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe here and on YouTube, and tell your friends to tune in next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.